TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing, but not just any Matthew Rushing. With me for this season of the podcast is the Neo-Constitution class refit Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, you're looking better than ever, I have to say.
Well, thank you. I feel a little bit more angular, a little more retro, you know, and which is really cool. I don't know, sleeker to me in a way. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I've tried to slim down a little bit, you know, lose some weight. And, you know, it's I feel like all those kids these days who are wearing 90s clothes again and thinking they're all hip and cool. And well, I'm just trying to be hip and cool as well. So, yes, definitely a Neo-Constitution retro design, and which, you know, well, I think we might have to talk about this episode.
I think so. And I will just also add that your updated hairstyle is also looking both retro and modern at the same time. I don't know how to describe it.
Well, like all of the TNG characters in this episode, I also have copious amounts of gray hair. And so, I feel right in line with all of them.
Me too. At least on my face, I do. Not so much up top yet. But anyway, okay, let's get into this. We're going to talk about the first episode of season 3, which is aptly titled The Next Generation. And maybe we could just start there because the title really has two meanings for me.
Yeah, it was I don't think we've ever had a episode that's named after basically a previous series in any way. And, of course, this is a phrase that's, you know, been popular even before the idea of Star Trek came along. And so, to me, it really signifies that this generation is going to be passing the torch to a next generation beyond them. And that is something that is continually happening. You know, every generation is passing the torch to the next generation. And that's what this feels like. And it also makes me wonder in some ways if the idea of generations, generational legacies, all of that type of stuff is something that's also a big part of, of this season, I think. And so, I mean, and it's cheeky, right? Like, it's okay to have fun in these things, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a little bit of fun, especially since we are celebrating this cast, this crew, and passing on from them legitimately.
Well, so, for me, the title, of course, refers to the next generation, the cast that has reunited for this season, but also the next generation of Starfleet officers, and some of them being offspring of those we're familiar with. The really standout moment is, of course, when they get to the bridge of the Titan and Picard asks Seven, is there something wrong with that ensign who's just smiling ear to ear? And Seven says, Ensign LaForge, back to your station. And then there's that moment. They say, wait, LaForge? Sydney LaForge? And it's just that direct connection to what happened in Generations with Kirk on the bridge with Damara Sulu. And not only that, but both Damara and Sydney are at the helm. And that was one of those moments where it's just this super obvious moment of homage and nostalgia, flashing back to another familiar film with moments from the original crew. And so you have that, and of course you've got the scene later on where Raffi is looking at her granddaughter in a computer projection. So you've got that generational thing. You've got Crusher's son, And you've got all these references to ships, you know, the Voyager B and the Enterprise F. And here we've got the Titan refit, which is now the Titan A, and all this stuff going on. So, and the other one was the moment when Picard tells Seven, don't you think we should tell engineering that we're going to go to warp 9.99? And she says, it's all automated these days. And that was another moment of the passage as the Next Generation. And of course, the opening scene with in the 25th century, which was exactly how The Wrath of Khan starts, except it's in the 23rd century. Yep. And as soon as I saw that come up on the screen, I knew I was in for a ride down memory lane throughout this episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the other thing, too, is that obviously, in a lot of ways, you know, you even have the idea of with Seven, you know, and she is the next generation, even though she has been a part of these shows for so long, she would be a part of that next generation that you would be handing the torch to be the next captain. I mean, we make reference to that here in this episode. And so,
a change in thinking a little bit in terms of being a Starfleet officer.
Exactly. So, you know, I think all of it, what I love about that is I think this is one of those places to me where Metallus is not above having a good time with this, which is, I think, something that, you know, fandoms, we do take things very seriously, and it's because we love it. But at the same time, I think that there's also just a beautiful and really well-earned place for us to be able to have fun. And there are a couple of places in the episode, of course, and we'll talk about later, where, you know, you get winked at, right? And I think, again, that's okay, especially when this whole season, and we know it, it is about trying to bring everything together and give these characters the send-off that they never got. You know, Metallus has talked about the idea that this is basically meant to be the undiscovered country for the Next Generation crew. And that movie did a lot of places, a lot of winking to the past as well. And that's not a problem, you know. So especially when you're trying to bring together the entire run of a crew that's been around for so many years. And so I think that's important.
Yeah. And bringing them back and also bringing in elements from Voyager and DS9 and so forth in this one story ties in for me with the lyrics to the song that's playing on Beverly's ship at the beginning, where if you look at the visuals, it feels like Beverly has been pining. I don't know if that's the right word. She's wants a connection to the past, I guess, both with Jean-Luc and with Jack, because you see the crate there that has Jack Crusher's name on it, and you've got this music playing, which we come to learn later on is from a mixtape that Picard made for her. And
Yes, the classic Picard romantic mixtape.
Yeah, yeah. In lieu of Roses and Wine, he's a real... He knows how to tug at the heartstrings, at least of Beverly. Mm-hmm. But
he probably even gave her like an actual cassette tape as well, you know.
He probably did.
And then he probably had to replicate her, you know, a cassette tape player, and much like, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy type of thing. So it's, yeah, it's very
fun. Love in this episode that they have an actual gramophone, but of course it's running off of some kind of high-tech interface. It's kind of like today, you know, vinyl is making a big comeback, and you can buy turntables, but they plug into your computer by USB cable, which is very interesting to me as someone who used to, you know, when I was in high school, junior high school and early high school, I bought everything on vinyl, and I just recorded it to cassette tape, and then I made a new tape when I wore that one out, and so I had an actual real turntable. Old style. But anyway, coming back to the point here with the mixtape is that the song is playing and the lyrics to the song are, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart, I have but one desire, and that one is you. No other will do. And looking at all of the creative work that's gone into this episode and how much it feels like the Star Trek that we had during all those years, the golden ages of the TNG, DS9, Voyager era, in particular visually, Enterprise being a prequel had its own look. And all the consternation on the part of so many fans in recent years about the look of the newer series that have come. And there's this longing for what we had before. And so it almost felt like this song was chosen also because the lyrics are a love letter to the next generation and that era. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't want to set the world on fire. I don't want to redesign everything. I don't want to make everything new. I just want to give you what you had before, what we all love, and no other will do.
Yeah, I think that's the thing here that, you know, and it's not a bad time to kind of like just get this out of the way up front, but you know, this episode is just full of Easter eggs. And, you know, I think even like my favorite is there's a changeling on the bridge of the Titan, you know, but they're just everywhere. Right. And I think they're so lovingly put in there because, and this is kind of what we were talking about when we were discussing seasons one and two, and then the interview that Metalis has done for the SFX magazine, where,
which we talked about on the previous episode of the show, anyone didn't hear it and you want to go back.
So, but there's you can tell that this comes from a place of love and respect for what came before. And to me, in many ways, this feels like everything that I thought Picard was basically going to be in the first season, because this season feels like a continuation of that universe. Mm-hmm, even though the starships look a little bit different, they're a little bit sleeker and everything, it's also 20 years since,
well, they would,
you
be,
know,
naturally.
I think. Exactly. Yeah. So the fact that those things have changed, but the starships also, you know, being on board the Titan, it had a nice feeling of the old and the new kind of put together, especially, you know, since they were very heavy in bringing the Lacars back and everything that we're very used to in the TNG universe. So
the color scheme of the Lacars, by the way, it's wonderfully updated to like today's aesthetics. The color scheme is really beautiful.
Yeah, no, 100%. So, you know, to me, this, like you were saying, this really truly does feel like an intentional love letter. And what's interesting, though, is the way you start this episode is the same way that season one started, which is it's a you know, old standard song playing against nebulas being shown.
Yeah.
So they're not only respecting everything that was done in, you know, what we might consider the Berman universe, you know, where from Next Generation all the way to Voyager,
the Bermanverse,
but the Bermanverse, you know, and gosh, they're even throwing all the way back to Enterprise, you know, because Frontier Day is the celebration of 250 years since the NX-01 went out. So, you know, all of that is happening here. And I think that I responded just so well to feeling like somebody cares about the things that came before, but also wants to give us a good story off of that, you know? And to me, none of this nostalgia felt like just nostalgia for that sake. There might be some points where you're laying it on slightly thick, but I also think, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording, but I honestly just think they feel like they're making up for lost time, because again, I think a lot of people, a lot of fans had kind of hoped that seasons one and two would have not necessarily the whole TNG cast back and everything, but just would feel more in line with everything that they had known before. And so this just feels like falling back into your favorite pair of jeans.
Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting way to put it. But yeah, it laying it on a little bit thick sometimes is a good way to describe some of my feelings as I was watching the episode. Not that I didn't love it all. In fact, I really loved it. But I also, what I had the thought of is that walking that tightrope between paying homage to all that has come before, showing how much you love what has come before, making up for lost time, as you just mentioned, and also telling a new story, balancing that, I feel, in the first episode here anyway, was very tricky. And I think that they did it well. But I think they did it well because it's sort of not a dangerous tightrope to walk, in my opinion, because
right.
we all want that. And so even if we look at it and it feels a bit too connected sometimes, or the references may be heavy-handed, like, you know, I knew, as I'm sure most everyone listening to this knew and you knew, when they're getting ready to leave space dock and Picard asks Seven to do the honors and take the ship out, Seven sits down in the chair and she says, "You can clear all moorings." I knew she was going to say aft thrusters, 1/4 impulse power. You know, it was obvious that's what she was going to say because that's what Kirk always said. And that's, if you go back to the Undiscovered Country, you know, Valeris couldn't imagine you would use 1/4 impulse power to leave. And so that's a kind of moment that, like, you knew it was going to be in there. You could just feel it coming, but still you're happy to see it because you've been wanting that, right? And mm-hmm. I say it's not a dangerous tightrope to walk because the people who don't know that, there it's going to go completely over their head, right? Because they don't know what came before. They're watching it new. And so for them, it's all new.
Right.
And so there's no harm done in that sense. So I feel like,
yeah,
you know, it's easy. It felt different. Let's put it this way. When Discovery, especially in its first season, would make these references to the past, it felt like trying to pull stuff in to add legitimacy to this redesign of the Star Trek universe that they had done. But here, it doesn't feel that way because the entire wrapping is already reminding you of that universe that had come before.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And this is one of the places where I think this is what happens when you add on to what came before anyway, right? You are going to be paying homage to what happened in the past, but moving forward, right? And maybe this is a great time to talk about it, but, you know, Picard himself even brings up this idea as he's talking to Laris about legacy. Mm-hmm. And he says he doesn't see himself as a man who needs a legacy, but he kind of feels like a man who's just more ready for the next adventure. And there's a great conversation between him and Laris because Laris is saying, look, it's okay. The past matters and that's fine. Which, you know, and she even says, you know, the point comes in a man's life when he looks to the past to define himself, not just the future. And I think in many ways that kind of mirrors the lesson of the second season, which Picard truly did need to learn the truth of the past and deal with it so that it could inform him in the present and then impact rightly the future. And in some ways, too, that reminds me of the theme from Generations, where Picard talks about what we leave behind is not as important as how we lived. I think that's echoing Picard saying, like, I'm not a man who's worried necessarily about what I'm leaving behind. It's about how I'm living. And then that is going to leave a legacy, right? But my goal in doing a thing is not, oh, I have to leave a legacy. It's no, for Picard, it's like, I need to do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. That's going to be the thing that leaves a legacy because it's not as important as what I leave behind. It's important how I lived. And so, like, I loved the way in which, you know, we're talking about this idea of legacy. And this whole show is rife with the idea of what is it that the TNG crew is leaving behind? What is it that the 24th century, as we knew it, now that we're in the 25th century, what is that legacy? And we're celebrating that through all of these Easter eggs and all this other stuff, but we're also celebrating it in putting these characters' lives kind of in perspective of mm-hmm. where the future of Star Trek can go. And mm-hmm. so I think, you know, I that's the thing that I think I'm most excited about this season, you know, and I love that we're doing that. It doesn't bother me that we're actually utilizing the past. I think that's the thing that bothered me the most about Picard season one, specifically some of season two and all of Discovery. And so this just feels like a very refreshing place to be for me. Mm-hmm. So
it also mirrors the same thing that was done with the original series cast as well. We already mentioned the Undiscovered Country, and you've got the situation here with Beverly and her son. And I almost wanted Picard to say, "Where is Dr. Crusher?" And for the boy to say, "I'm Dr. Crusher." Like, no, I mean, Beverly. And, you know, you have that reveal of, okay, well, it's her son. And we talked about that on the last show, predicting that, yeah, that guy on the poster is probably Beverly's son. And sure enough, it was, but that was a pretty easy mm-hmm. thing to guess, I think. But,
and probably Picard's son.
And I'm sure that's Picard's son as well. Yeah. And in fact, there are bits of dialogue in the episode, plus the music set up at the beginning that we just talked about, Beverly reflecting on her past with Picard. All of that sort of leads to the idea that it is Picard's son. And I think even the way... So in this episode, her son isn't given a name, but we know from promotional materials that his name is Jack. And so Jack here, the way that he responds to the situation after he's backed down from trying to attack them, and then he's, you know, he's gone to the panel, the enemy's coming back in. To me, it felt like the way I could see Picard, a young Picard reacting in a situation like that. I might be reading mm-hmm. too much into it, but if you just think about how, you know, I think that not only nurturing, you know, growing up with someone influences how you behave, but I feel like right. there's something in the genes as well that people will maybe tend to become similar type of people, especially in reactions like that. It's a personal observation. I'm sure some people will think I'm right. crazy for saying that, but I just feel like that was also a little bit of a hint that, yeah, this is Picard's son.
Right.
Yeah. But it mirrors anyway, the Wrath of Khan and the whole situation with Kirk and yes. David and all that, right, is my point.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I think yeah. that's the thing that, you know, this is obviously playing off that situation, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I'm interested to see where that goes, you know, and I don't have an issue with that being the case. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is specifically just about Beverly and the fact that, you know, she's on Elios, you know, she's a part of, and we've read the interviews and basically Doctors Without Borders, mm-hmm. And they're being chased across the galaxy, and we don't know why yet. He even mentions they've been to like three different places they've shown up, and they always have different faces. Right. So a little hint of like why. But one of the things that was most interesting to me about Beverly and her relationship with the TNG crew, like she hasn't really been in touch with any of them for 20 years. She's just kind of cut them all off. And I was trying to piece things together, and the Instagram, there's a official Star Trek account called Star Trek Logs, and they were doing these little promo videos for the new season of Picard, and done in the cool Lacars format with all these different characters. And they had one for the Enterprise, and the Enterprise E's last mission apparently was classified. Hmm. And it made me wonder if something like what happened to in the Time 2 books, and the Tezwa affair, something of that nature maybe happened on that mission that soured her relationship with Starfleet and the rest of the crew, which led her to leaving. Mm-hmm. And could this have some kind of connection with where we get our villain as well, which is why this villain seems personally involved with all of these characters. And so to me there's just lots of pieces here. And then of course the fact that she and Picard did try a romance, but it's very clear that she's not over it because she's listening to his logs as she sleeps. Mm-hmm. It seems like, you know, that's what helps calm her down. But of course she's also continuously listening to Picard's romantic mixtape. So there's a lot here with this character of Beverly, and I can completely understand why Gates McFadden would be so excited to come back, because she's kind of pivotal to this season. Like, she's the impetus for the entire adventure happening.
Yeah, I like that idea, and I did read the Time to series, but it's been quite a long time, and I know you're more up on it than I am. So that's a really good potential connection there. And given the fact that in Star Trek since 2017, when Discovery came back around, has been incorporating elements from books, comics, and Star Trek Online and elsewhere, it's a possibility. I would love if they did that, because one thing that you and I have discussed outside of the show quite often is and many fans probably had the same feeling, the disappointment that Beverly had not appeared in the first two seasons, but also the fact that the storyline that we were getting contradicted what happened in the books. And I don't think there's any way that they can reconcile it where it's all going to fit together.
Sure.
But if they did pick up a thread from an older book series like that one and somehow tie it in, I think it would make us feel a little bit better about the progression of the post-TNG mm-hmm. on-screen era and what we are finally getting here.
Yeah. I think, too, just on top of that, you know, it helps explain, too, very well then, and I think Metalis is very cognizant of this idea that all fans were thinking in their minds, well, what the F happened to Beverly? Mm-hmm. And the idea that they would have a relationship, because that's so clear that that was the case throughout the series and that it never happened in the movies. I know it's one of the things that Gates McFadden was very frustrated with the films in general as well. And so actually giving us this answer that not only did they try to have a romance, it apparently did not go well, and there could have been other extenuating circumstances. And then on top of that, the fact that we're both pretty confident that this is going to be her son. This is going to be their son.
Their son, yeah.
All of that can really add to an interesting understanding then of what happened with these characters.
Yeah. Yeah, on the surface level, when you're watching this, you might get the feeling that Beverly was pregnant, Jean-Luc didn't know, and she cut off all relations with all her former crewmates as part of a way of concealing or hiding that. But I don't think it's going to be that superficial. And I think that's probably not going to be the actual reason.
Right.
And so that's one reason I like your speculation. And as far as what's going on, like how Beverly might be involved and what's going on with this enemy, at the end of the episode, there's this beautiful, like, slow pan across the Elkar's panels. And if you watch that, and especially if you freeze frame it and you watch it really carefully, there's all kinds of information on those panels, all kinds of clues to what the story might be. It's sort of like the way they put those clues in the opening credits of Discovery and Picard. And here it's less subtle. There's like a lot of information on those screens.
Right.
And one of the screens there's a final screen where it pulls back and you can see that these are displays one on top of the other on a large panel. But as it pans, you see a few screens that have things to do with medical research. And there's one.
Yes.
There's one that says comparison human genome, and it has the human DNA strand with the Gattaca, everything there. And it makes, and they mention, so Jack Crusher here mentions that they had a different face every time. And the ship, when at the very end of the episode, when Picard and Riker ask, who's chasing you? And he says, take a look for yourself. And the ship comes through. The ship to me felt like a Sona ship from Insurrection. And then if you get to the final panels there where they're panning across the Elcars, there's one moment where they show a ship. It's yellow, and it really looks like a Sona ship. It looks a lot like Raffo's ship from Insurrection.
Ooh, that would be fascinating,
and
yeah.
It looks so much like that that I wouldn't be surprised if there might be some connection here to the Sona, but it feels like whoever's involved is doing some kind of genetic research, and it has to do with something with the human genome that maybe they'll benefit from incorporating human DNA. There's also a DNA strand in those final credits there, which could tie to that and could also tie into the idea of Jack Crusher here being Jean-Luc and Beverly's son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I like that idea of just because of thinking of this, the villain there, when I think back to the look of them, I'm like, yeah, looks very Sona-like.
Yeah, I mean, they're not so, the Sona that we're familiar with, but they look kind of,
well,
it reminds
just,
you
I mean,
of
I'm
that.
I'm
bit,
speaking
right?
Yeah, I'm speaking specifically of the female villain.
Yeah.
She just looks very much like there's something about her that you're like, oh, you could totally see her being a Sona, which, you know, that's an interesting, we can jump off of that because, you know, just the villain obviously hasn't been revealed other than the ship there. Mm-hmm. And yet the story with Raffi gives us some really interesting clues as to what they're up to, as does that finale as you're watching the Lacars go by and the credits.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's been tracking these people for months. They've stolen tech from the Daystrom Institute, which is quantum subspace tunneling tech, which we see them use
in
Sector 7.
Interesting here, they call it the Daystrom Station, I believe, right? So it seems to be a separate facility from the one on Earth, but probably part of the same institute.
No, I think you're right,
yeah.
And you know, they launch this attack in Sector 7 on Starfleet Recruitment Office, which, you know, the Red Lady was Captain Rachel Garrett, a statue they were going to be uncovering for Frontier Day.
Yeah, which was an interesting choice, too, I thought. Like, I watched this the first time on my big TV in the living room, but my vision is not good, and so things are a bit blurry, and I couldn't tell clearly who that was, and I thought, oh, maybe it's Janeway. And then when I went back and rewatched on my iPad where I can get up close and see, then I could see who it was and read the text and everything.
Yeah, I think with this whole thing with the villain and their story, you know, I love your idea of it being the Sona because they would have a reason to be pissed off at Picard and the crew of the Enterprise.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, there would be possibly those that would not forgive Picard and the Baku. And I love that. And of course, you know, it's even clear earlier in the episode that at 10 forward that Riker and Picard are being watched. And so, but something about all of that made me really interested was Raffi's handler for Starfleet Intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you because there's this section where they call her a warrior. They said, you are a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought is that her handler is Worf, and we just don't know it yet, because he's been said to be kind of like a samurai in this season. And it just, that even the text as it was coming through sounded like Worf. It's straight to the point. It's not verbose. And him saying that, the character, the handler saying, you are a warrior, I was like, that just sounds like something Worf would say to
somebody. Yeah, that's a really interesting observation because I didn't think about it when I was watching. I felt, the first time especially, but even the second time I watched, I felt like she was interacting with an artificial intelligence. I think part of that is that I've grown accustomed to that in Star Trek a bit more, in some of the more, you know, the more modern story right. on the timeline in the stories, but also in our own world. Just these days, AI is becoming so prominent, and you know, I'm using now ChatGPT as part of my work.
Yeah,
you
know, I was going to say, you know, we've all played with that now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I not only play with it, I actually subscribe to it. I have like a pro account on it, and I use it for, because I'm an editor, I have to do a lot of research. And I know it's not accurate, and so I don't trust the information necessarily, but what it's really useful for is finding mm-hmm. paths to something when you're having trouble finding a path to a certain topic and finding a certain source, sure. and then you can go research more. And it's also great, you know, when you are stuck and you just need some inspiration to get unstuck, you know, as a writer.
Right.
It's great. But because I'm growing accustomed to interacting with an AI like that, or even with smart home assistants, which, by the way, just quick sidebar, I feel like there's this passive-aggressive narrative going on throughout this entire episode about how useless smart home speakers are. When you ask them something and they say, unknown, or I can't help you, I can't do that. Here's some results I found on the web, because Picard says, yeah, of course I know what that is. Well, thank you very much. That's not very helpful. And Raffi is also the same way to it. Like, oh, well, that's useless. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. it's kind of like a modern, like a contemporary commentary going on through here. But to get back track to what I was saying here about AIs is that maybe for that reason, I felt like Raffi was interacting with an AI. But mm-hmm. your observation about the warrior part makes perfect sense, because we know Worf's going to be coming in to the story. Mm-hmm. It makes sense because he worked in security for so long. It makes perfect sense that he would be involved in security and intelligence, and the references to being a warrior would be the perfect link to bring him in. And mm-hmm. so how do you get Worf into the story? Is it going to be another, Mr. Worf, what the hell are you doing here? He just pops in, or are you going to actually create a believable path for him to show up on the story, which I think, yes, they are going to do. So that makes sense to me, yeah.
It also, the thing about this is too, is it made me wonder, you know, the idea that Worf is kind of this samurai-like character who's kind of, you know, traveling the galaxy and working to help people out. It also just made me wonder, because it looks like in the trailers we're going to get a scene where Worf and Raffi fight hand-to-hand combat mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so it made me wonder if he has, through the grapevine and through his travels, realized that this character needs help and has found a way to pose as even Starfleet intelligence, and in his travels, you know, he hears things, right? And so again, like, all of this is kind of going through my mind as I'm seeing that, and I'm very interested to see what happens with that character. I'm also, you know, thankful even just in the story for Raffi. I love the idea that she's struggling still, like, to say no to her addictions and everything, mm-hmm. but I really appreciated the fact that they didn't have her actually being high then or any of those things. She's putting on an act. She's doing her job. And as difficult as it is, it feels like, again, this is a good continuation from season two. The character of Raffi went through a lot in season two, and it seems like she's in a better place. It's not easy. It never is when it comes to addiction, but this is a character who has moved to a different place.
Right.
And which leads me to a whole other thing, Chris, I got to ask you about. The timeline of this show blew me away. I had not realized this until somebody put on Twitter and I did some research. This season takes place 10 years after season two. Mm-hmm. And so that allows for this large swath of time to have happened between, you know, what we found in what we were left with is season two, and now where we are in season three. Mm-hmm. And it definitely seems like a lot has happened in these characters' right. lives right. in that time period.
Well, yeah, I think that the story that we're getting needs that 10 years. Otherwise, it doesn't quite fit together coming out of season two. Before I share thoughts on that, just rewind for a second to the thing about Raffi. I just wanted to make the observation that she's in a better place, as you said, but she's struggling still and struggling to stay away from those addictions. And she's been put in a situation with this Operation Daybreak that she's part of, where she's in the middle of drug dealers right. and the right. addictions that she had. And so that makes it extremely difficult for her. And I think in terms of storytelling, it's a great thing to do with the character.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
So as for the timeline, there are a lot of things here. I mean, Seven, to be first officer of the Titan, to be commander here, is you need that time. It takes time for her to reach that point. There's a comment from Riker that Deanna and Kestra would appreciate some time away from me. I thought that was interesting, and I made a note. What does that mean? Of course, I can imagine things that it means, but it's going to be curious to see what it means for the story. But last time we saw them, everything was fine, other than, of right. course, you know, they had the loss of their son. But I think for Deanna and Will and Kestra, everything was fine. So you need some significant passage of time to get to that comment, I feel like. And
yeah.
And to be honest, one observation, one thing that I felt watching this is that you can feel that Patrick Stewart is getting older in his voice, in his right. delivery. Yeah. He seems,
oh,
his
absolutely.
Energy level is a lot lower than before. He still does a brilliant job. He's a wonderful actor. But you can feel the difference in just the few years that have been passing during this series. And so I think having a bit more passage of time for the story helps that to also feel a bit more in place for the character.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that what it does is that it gives us the opportunity to see, and it really does feel like that the time passage here, Picard does feel like a very secure and healthy version of himself.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he and Laris have been living together yeah. for the last 10 years right. and seem very happy together and yeah. very comfortable in their life together.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. I mean, you know, when I think of where we left off in that season, it's a good thing. You know, there was a comic series that came out with Picard and Seven that kind of is in the between these seasons, and I was struggling to figure out exactly how I felt about the comic, because there were some things in there that didn't quite feel right. But knowing mm-hmm. that comic was just a small part of this 10-year period makes it make so much more sense now. And again, I think what it allows here too is the fact that it's been 20 years since the final mission or whatever happened with Beverly and the rest of the crew. So there's mm-hmm. this long span of time, which obviously also leads us to have, you know, most likely 20 years old is perfect for the age of her son, yeah. which, you know,
right. yeah, exactly.
is perfect for Picard and yeah. her. To have gotten together and that to be their son. So, yeah. I mean, all of this makes sense.
Right. And Picard has the line in here where he tells Laris that he hasn't spoken to Beverly in, I think he says, more than 20 years. Because mm-hmm. when I was thinking about the prospect of this being their son, I was, you know, looking at the actor who was cast, and I was thinking about the age and like, okay, well, does it need to be exactly 20 right. years? It's like 23. Something like that to make it work.
Yeah,
and
no,
I think they do right. kind of blur the lines here in the dialogue that it's not exactly yes. 20 years. And having that little bit of wiggle room allows that to work.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
The thing about yep. Laris, like you said, it's really important, I think, that Laris and Picard have been together. They've been living together for 10 years at the chateau. And yeah, Picard does feel much more comfortable, and they feel very comfortable together. I think Orla Brady does such an amazing job of portraying that character in a very natural way. And she did one thing that I noticed that I thought was just incredible for delivering the line. Picard says, "I'll be back in a few days, you know, 2 or 3 days," I think he says, maybe even less. And then she says, maybe even more. And she stumbles on the wording of that. And I just thought that so much emotion came through in that, of what it meant to her for him to be leaving when they had these other plans, I thought was really well done. And I was so happy to see that in the beginning of the episode, that Laris was there and they were together, because we talked on the previous episode of this podcast about the prospects of that happening and how we wanted to know what happened between them. We wanted that continuation.
Right.
And I think I said that I doubt it's going to happen. I think they're probably just going to move on. And I think the fact that they didn't just move on, and not only did they have her there, but she was there a lot in the beginning and it was pivotal to Picard's character, I think also showed a lot of respect for what they've done on this series up to this point.
Yes.
Even as 100%. They're drastically changing the tone.
Yes. I 100% agree with you. I could not be happier the fact that Metalis cares not only about our beloved 24th century, you know, what we all knew, but he has lovingly dealt with, I think, everything that's kind of come before with the first two seasons of Picard. And in many ways, I think taken more seriously than anyone else in this, trying to create some sense of continuity. And when you were talking about that whole thing with Laris, I was thinking to myself, what she said implied to me that she thinks that there's a possibility he might not be coming back to her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You can see it in her face, even.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that there is that it feels like to me that she's very aware of the fact that whatever happened, and she doesn't, I think she senses whatever happened between Picard and Crusher, Crusher was the love of his life that got away, and that he, because he was unhealthy emotionally at the time, is what is one of the things that led them to not be able to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this possibility of them, you know, reconnecting, I think she realizes that, you know, that could possibly be the case, that, you know, they might find their way back to each other. And so I think that's really interesting. Chris, a big topic that I wanted to discuss with you, and this is going to, there's going to be a bunch of different things that kind of go into this, but first, we have this brand new ship. We kind of we're poking fun at the idea of being the Neo Constitution class Matthew Rushing, which, by the way, I gotta say, I look so much better than I used to. But we have the new Titan, which the new Titan is actually a massive refit of Riker's Titan, and it's been reconstructed into what they call the Neo Constitution class, which Metalis said the reason behind that was this idea of, you know, we have retro looking cars, but with new tech in them. What if Starfleet did that? And, you know, he had seen a starship designed by Bill Krause, who's a digital artist, the Shangri-La, and it had, you know, the TNG era saucer on the top with an Excelsior inspired next generation curve on the bottom. He thought it was interesting, and they basically turned that into the Titan. And so first wanted to ask you, because I was very skeptical about this ship when we first saw it and everything, and I, getting a chance to spend some time with this new ship, what did you think of its design? Has it grown on you? Are you liking it? Do you feel like even that background knowledge of kind of how it was designed and why makes sense?
Well, yeah, I think the reasoning behind the design makes perfect sense, and I really like that. And I think that's what would probably happen in the real world. And so just doing that makes the universe feel more real for me. As far as what I think about the design, the interior I really like. The bridge is really great, and the lighting works really well for me. Just the set design, everything I really like. And it really feels like a real starship, I would say, as if I would know, like, we have real starships, but, you know, mm-hmm. just...
I mean, of course we have real starships, yeah. Chris.
Well, we kind of do. At least we call them that. But no, I mean, if you think back to, you know, like the Enterprise D bridge or things like that, this, like, really feels right, like a exactly. real functional starship. And compared to the J.J. Abrams films, for example, that super bright Apple Store bridge, which it's pretty, but I think that the bridge we see here is what would probably really be designed for a ship going on missions mm-hmm. like this. The exterior yeah. is what's interesting. From different angles, I think it looks great. And from other angles, it looks like, I think, kit bashing is the word that came to my mind a little mm-hmm. bit. You know, like, if you think about toys in the past, action figures and so forth, you know, taking parts yeah. from different ones and creating new ones out of that, which companies did, mm-hmm. and it's called kit bashing. It felt a little bit like that. Like, the secondary hull reminds me a lot of the original Constitution class, and then you've got
yeah.
elements in the middle where it feels like they're, like, connecting different designs and making them fit together. And so from certain angles, it has a chunky, awkward feel to it. This is my first impression, mm-hmm. by the way. I've watched the episode twice. After I watch it more, I might examine it more and find that I really love the way it's put together. But overall, I think it's a nice design, but yeah, but I guess that feeling that I have is part of that retro aspect.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting because I'm looking at my model of the Titan mm-hmm. and, you know, it's very clear to me that in many ways, you know, they actually pull off these nacelles mm-hmm. And the struts, and those struts are the ones that are reconfigured into being the ones that are used on the Titan
mm-hmm.
A. Even the bottom of the ship here with the way that the structure looks, mm-hmm. it looks very similar to what we get. And so there are places where they have reused pieces of Riker's Titan
mm-hmm.
and then kind of given it that, again, neo-constitution class, they've got the old school saucer look,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got these very intense, this ship actually has, I think, the most powerful, I was reading, it has the most powerful impulse engines in the fleet,
mm-hmm.
And which makes sense that this is an exploratory vessel. It's one that could possibly, you know, when you think of, like, needing your tractor beam and mm-hmm. like impulse power and those mm-hmm. kind of things, all the things you might be doing when you're doing exploration.
Yeah.
This makes sense as a ship. So,
well, it also has the captain with the most powerful ego in the fleet, apparently.
yes, it does. But so for myself, the ship has absolutely grown on me in a way mm-hmm. that I did not expect it to. And I'm liking the design more and more, which is actually something I didn't expect. And so I'm looking to seeing more of it and spending more time on the Titan. I'm glad that the Titan is kind of going to be the ship that we spend the most time with, it seems like, this season. So I'm very excited about that. But yes, we should talk about Captain Liam Shaw, who may be the largest a-hole in the fleet.
I think so. I think so. In my notes, I used a different word. I just said, like, he's an absolute douche.
I mean, it's like Jellicoe and Stiles had a child.
Right.
And this is what happened. Like,
and that child did eye training with Gowron because that look he does with his eyes towards the end, I'm watching that and that look, I'm like, no normal person does that with their eyes. What did you think your comments and your insults weren't douchey enough that you've then got to give that eyeball thing that you do there at the end just to make sure that everybody knows how you really feel about them being here at this table?
I know you're 100% right. And I think that what's great about this is that this is the beauty. And we talked about this at the beginning. You know, Shaw is the juxtaposition of 2-7.
Yeah.
7 is, and again, we've had this juxtaposition in Star Trek before, especially in the original series movies with Stiles. You have this very by-the-book captain and all of these things where he can't think outside the box, right? And then you have the Maverick, Kirk. And the beauty here is that, you know, 7 is the antithesis to that. She is the one who has learned from Janeway, has learned from Picard, you know, who, you know, both have that Kirk streak in them, which is that they think with their gut, their intuition, and that's what she's longing to do with her place in Starfleet. And Shaw is the complete opposite of that. An officer who's only going to do what they're told, when they're told, and isn't going to think outside the box, because it's like he doesn't really care about the thing that, you know, Kirk and Picard talked about in Generations, which is the idea of making a difference. Don't let them ever take you off that bridge, because when you're in that chair, you can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I love him as kind of this like swarmy captain villain, but I love because it's the thing that is this adversity for 7 is something that I think is going to be so interesting to watch her be able to overcome, which is and it's going to make her a great captain in the end when she can overcome it. And and I especially even love that moment in, you know, as they're about to leave Will and Jean-Luc, he turns to her and he says, "Thank you, 7," which is such a great moment because Shaw is such a jerk. He's making her use her the name to which she has not been known for so long, because...
Well, and she doesn't even want to use that.
Because when she
name.
Reclaimed herself, she became 7.
Yeah.
You know, she still was 7.
Yeah.
And that was a way of her... Great connection. This was a way of her connecting her past with her present and her future, right? And that, so yes, she is all, there's a part of her that is always going to be tied to what the Borg did to her. And yet she has reclaimed that and made that her own by taking on the mantle of the name 7 in and of herself. And to be denied that by this jerk, Shaw, is just one more thing that, of course, makes us hate him. So
yeah. Well, he tells her that, you know, you just loyaltied, I think is the word he used, your way out of a career or a commission. And, you know, in the end, she's going to come out of this well and is, like you say, going to grow and probably become a great captain. And I suspect that he is not going to come out of this well. Even though we do see in those closing credits with the Elkars, there's a screen where it has a performance evaluation that he has filed about her, and it has confidential stamped over it, and we can't really see any of the text. So I thought that was interesting to see there. But in the end, I it wouldn't surprise me if she is the captain, or at least the acting captain of the Titan by the end of the season. And he's either dead or he has done something that has gotten himself discharged, or I don't know. But
yeah, no, I
he doesn't seem like a character that's going to be around, you know, throughout the season.
No, I don't know if anybody really wants him around.
I don't.
Throughout the entire season.
I certainly don't want to have dinner with him.
No. Well, the fact that he stuck his nose up at at Chateau Picard is reason enough not to want to have dinner with him.
And you know, the thing is that he probably loves Chateau Picard wine, but he just wanted to stick it to Jean-Luc at the table there and just act like he didn't care about it. I suspect. While we're talking about Seven, I just wanted to say that she, I think, just knocks the ball out of the park acting in this episode. She has that character down so well and has evolved the character so much from the character on Voyager, but also the character that we first meet in Picard in this series. And we talked about the 10-year gap. You can feel how she grew Seven during that 10-year gap, which we didn't see. And her vocal cadence, her presentation, her mannerisms are very much connected to the character that she portrayed on Voyager, but with so much more confidence and experience behind it. And then also Jeri Ryan, I mean, she looks more beautiful and vibrant than she's ever looked as this character here today. And she's so much older now than she was, of course, when she portrayed Seven for all those years on Voyager. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing.
No, I think that's a great point. I think she does such a great job in this episode as well. And even just the little moments to which this character is really struggling with what's happening, right? I think she is struggling with the fact that this is going to cost her. And it could cost her everything that she has been trying to work for. And I think that's something that I love about her performance here in this episode. But again, I think the beauty of it is that she's willing to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, regardless of, you know, damn the regulations. And damn the captain that she's serving under, who can't see past his own nose, you know, or his own decanted wine. You know, so I think that's really awesome about her in this episode and the character. And so it also, I think it's also the beauty of when we talked about the idea of the next generation. She's the one you want to see grab the baton. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the type of character you do want to see. So I love that. Chris, I guess we're kind of winding down a little bit. This is an episode I feel like, and I feel like this whole season is going to be like this, where you could probably talk hours about these episodes just because there's so much.
Oh, there's tons of stuff we haven't even mentioned that so much. I could certainly talk about at length, but yeah, we can't do it all today.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you about the music choices, because here, this is another place where I feel like there is a very clear choice made, which is we are going to be honoring not just the past of the Next Generation, but the greatest of Star Trek music from the films to the Next Generation. And did you like that? Did you feel like it fit within the show and that it was a good choice for them to make?
Yeah, I think it fit perfectly, because the settings, like, one thing that stood out for me is I love the music from The Wrath of Khan and The Search for Spock, and the moments of the Enterprise setting out on its mission, leaving space dock, Kirk stealing the Enterprise in The Search for Spock. And they used either extensive portions of that music, or they took cues from it and made something new out of it that still felt like it was written for those films. And I thought it did a wonderful job of it. It was one of the biggest feelings of nostalgia I had watching this, because I've seen those films so many times, just so many times. And being a musician myself, an orchestral musician, you know, trained in music, I play bass trombone, I spent years playing the symphony orchestra, and I've had opportunity even to play this music in like pop orchestras. something I love so much. And those original series films were, they came along at such an important time in my life when I was studying music and I was developing as a person, and Star Trek influenced that development. So that particular music has a very strong connect. It's like Picard said at the beginning of the episode, actually, to Laris, that, you know, these things are their connections to the past, friends old and new, but they're memories. And for me, the music brings back so many memories. But I thought it felt mm-hmm. It fit with the scene so well and what was going on. And it was one of the reasons that I felt so much like this episode was a love letter to all of Star Trek past and to the fans in a way that just made you smile and like remember your own past life in a way that that other time they tried to do a love letter at the end of Enterprise didn't work. This one works so well. And that's my thought on the music that relates to the original series films. I do have a thought on mm-hmm. the opening theme from First Contact, but let's come back to that so you can share your sure. thoughts on the film music, the TOS stuff.
Yeah, what was interesting to me was that not only were there references to Goldsmith and Horner, but there was actually mm-hmm. a reference there to Eitelman from mm-hmm. Star Trek VI. Yeah. The section where they're sitting in the bar talking,
mm-hmm.
there's a small piece of music that happens in Star Trek VI, which is actually my favorite score for Star Trek movies, and it's just this refrain of, and it's like this. It's a very subtle piece mm-hmm. of music, and he uses I believe it's Stephen Barton who's doing the music here for season 3, and him using that is such a genius move, and it's such a deep pull mm-hmm. because it's not a piece of music to which everybody would immediately be familiar if you're not somebody like you or myself and many of the other fans who spend lots and lots of time listening to these soundtracks. I mean, mm-hmm. I listen to the Star Trek soundtracks a lot, especially the TOS films, because I absolutely love them and I think they're great. And again, Six is my absolute favorite, actually. And so I think there's just something really special about him choosing to do this with the music, because mm-hmm. again, it's not just a love letter to the Next Generation, but it's a love letter to Star Trek and the Star Trek that fans felt so connected to from the original series mm-hmm. all those years, all the way through Enterprise, where it felt very continuous.
Yeah.
And this feels so much in line with that.
Yeah.
That it feels like coming home.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Because, like, I think the music that Michael Giacchino has written for the JJ films and the stuff that Jeff Russo's done for the newer series and all, it's all great, but it has its own certain feel to it. And I love that music as well. But it's not the same as what we had from Eitelman and Goldsmith and Horner back during that time period. And hearing that sound, which for me, that's the Star Trek orchestral sound. That's mm-hmm. that's the feeling that really says Star Trek to me, just like John Williams' scores for Star Wars say Star Wars to me, and the newer stuff that we're getting, while also great, doesn't make me think about the Star Trek that I grew up with, whereas this very much does, and that was obviously the goal here, and so it fit very well. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about regarding music as we wrap up here is, I was surprised that the overture, the theme from First Contact, was used for the title credits and also for the closing. Now, it's actually one of my absolute favorite pieces from any Star Trek film. I remember sitting in the theater watching that film for the first time and being blown away by that opening. But do you think that's going to be the theme for all the episodes through all the season? Or was that something that they're just doing for this part one here to get us into this?
I don't really know, mainly because I feel like I don't know what to expect from them in this season and what they are going to pull out of the bag. But I love it. I mean, I think...
Because I don't know if it fits the story, I guess is the thing. Like, that piece of music fit the film First Contact and that story so perfectly that I could... It's brilliant. I don't know that I feel that it fits the story that we got in this first episode and that we're likely to get through this season in the same way. So it really felt like a move for nostalgic reasons. Like, that's the most popular TNG film. We've brought everybody back. But I don't know if that's going to be the theme for the season or if we're going to have something, a variation. Like, you know, season one and season two Picard had basically the same opening theme, but it was a variation on it. So it did feel different.
Yeah, I think the thing is that First Contact's music is the music to which I think most fans would associate with TNG outside of the main theme, which goes all the way back to the motion picture. And I think First Contact is the music to which fans most gravitate towards and it was the first thing that really Goldsmith had created that seemed to kind of fit within the vernacular of Star Trek film music for the Next Generation that was not just that original theme from, you know, that was kind of reworked a little bit from the motion picture. And so, because, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the soundtrack for, you know, Star Trek Generations by Dennis McCarthy. It's a little too breathy.
I love that soundtrack.
For me. So it's fine. It's just not my favorite. And part of that is because there's something I think about Goldsmith's orchestrations, which just have a little bit more like depth and resonance to them. And I appreciate that. So all that said is it makes me wonder, will they continue to use First Contact, or was this just kind of a way to open up the show? And then they might, I don't know, rework other things to fit within the show. So it'll be interesting because if this goes the way that you were kind of suggesting with the villain, maybe being a Sona connection, well, would they use any of the Insurrection music, which is also done by Jerry Goldsmith? And that was a beautiful theme as well, that idyllic, you know, a beautiful music that they used for that movie. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't have a problem with it. It worked. And part of it was, is that it's the most, I think you said it well, it's the most identifiable Next Generation music outside of the main Next Generation theme from the TV show.
Yeah. It'd be interesting if they took the core Picard theme and they added some elements from Insurrection into it to create a third variation on that theme. I'm trying to imagine what that would sound like, but it could be interesting.
Well, it also made me just wonder if the reason that, I mean, that this show just kind of opens the way it does because it is opening more cinematically and that we haven't really gotten to the point in the episode or in the long form movie where we get the full theme, you know, like, because it feels like this episode and the second episode are actually really connected as like kind of a small mini arc, and that at like maybe at the end of that second episode, you would actually have the full representation of what the main theme for the season would be musically.
Yeah. And last point on this before we wrap up here, because we're talking about it opening up with that theme music, I was so happy that we had the episode title on the screen finally again.
Yeah. Well, when it says part one, you know, like, again, not every single show needs to feel like one continuous long form film, basically, that's been cut up into parts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think specifically what Metalis is trying to do here, which is to create that last big film for this cast because they didn't get what they deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do it the way he has done it, I think in many ways it actually reminds me of the last four episodes of The Clone Wars, those four episodes are in parts, right?
Yeah.
And right. They have those title cards, and that's kind of what this feels like in many ways.
Yeah. But here, beyond the title cards for the parts, just having the title of the episode on the screen was wonderful, because in live action Star Trek, you know, we haven't had that in so long, and it's kind of frustrating, I think. And if you're going to take us back to the good old days of the TNG era, you got to have that on the screen. So I'm glad that was there.
100% agree with you.
All right. Well, what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one?
It's well established. Season one was kind of a dud for me. Season two got better. And this season has just started off with a bang.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more than anything, I hate to say this because I feel like I just keep praising the guy, but Metalis just seems to understand what I was looking for the whole time. And so for me personally, he's provided everything that I was hoping we would be getting from a Star Trek Picard series. And so for that, I'm 100% appreciative, and I couldn't be more thankful that this season has started off incredible. We started off with Beverly kicking some serious ass.
Yeah.
So, I mean, gosh, you got me there. And just there's so much hope for me that everything that I was kind of seeing from the trailers and kind of feeling from the trailers was put into this first episode to continue that hope, right? Mm-hmm. And so is Metalis a new hope? Yes, he is. And so hopefully they will give him much more Star Trek to do. If they don't, they're idiots. And I'm going to give this 4.75 DNA strands.
Excellent.
Out of 5.
Excellent.
So.
All right. Well, I mean, you said basically the way I feel about it as well. I thought it was wonderful. I did feel that attempt to walk the tightrope that I mentioned earlier, trying to balance the references to the past with a new story. Things like the boatswain whistle, taking you back to the Wrath of Khan, or the Undiscovered Country.
Even we didn't even talk about, Chris, like the sound effects. So many sound effects were like pulled from the archives. And I was like, thank you for making it sound like Star Trek again.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And in a way that makes sense, right? Not a sound effect thrown
in.
Yes,
yes.
That's a familiar one, but used in a way that doesn't quite make sense. But anyway, you know, I felt that a little bit. But at the same time, even though I did feel like they were laying it on a little bit thick at times, I was thrilled by it because that's what I wanted. And so I was very happy with it. And the story, what I find interesting is that many elements of the story are very familiar. They're like echoes of stories that we've seen in the past, with the original series crew aging, and now we're getting it with TNG. And that makes sense. But we're also getting new elements to the story as well, and I'm looking forward to seeing how those are blended together. But it's just been wonderful to see them all back on the screen again. So I'm going to give this 9.99 Eagle Moss Enterprise D models, you know, the fat ones. I thought it was so funny when they pan down, and it's literally Eagle Moss Shop sitting on the shelf.
Yes, that was very, very funny.
And then the exchange. And
I liked that because, yeah. In all honesty, that's how I personally feel about I was never a big fan of the Enterprise D. And so I know it might be, Picard's favorite, but it was not mine. And so,
yeah.
Yes.
Although I will say I do like the Eagle Moss Enterprise D ship itself. As a starship, of course, I prefer like the 1701 refit is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
Of all, I mean,
I've got the D hanging up above me here. You know, yeah. So I mean, I've got that, and I've got the E, I've got the A. Yeah. You know, I've got the original, I've got the B and the C. So you know, I've got most of them.
You've got them all. Bloody A, B, C, D, and E.
Yeah, I don't have the F because that ship I hate. Yeah. So.
And you don't have the J because it's so spindly.
I do not have the
J. Might break if you touch the nacelles.
Exactly.
The struts.
Exactly.
But I love the exchange there, though. Riker asks, how come you have so many Enterprise Ds? And the bartender says, oh, the fat ones? No one wants those.
Yeah.
Then Riker, you'd better leave the bottle. I love that part.
Yes.
All right,
yes.
Everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on The Next Generation, meaning the episode called The Next Generation here, starting season 3 of Picard. There are many ways for you to share those with us and your fellow listeners. Probably the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it works. If not, if you're joining for the first time, search Babel, B-A-B-E-L, on Facebook. It should come right on up. If not, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We do keep it there for listeners to extend the discussion beyond the podcasts and not just another random generic Star Trek group like there are so many on Facebook. So this one is our listeners group, and we hope to see you there. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that as well. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and your message will dance its way right over to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Well, Matthew, when you're not trying to figure out exactly how much Beverly you're going to see in the next episode, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me all over the place under the name MattRushing02 on Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, Vero. You can also find me here on the network doing a bunch of different shows. Of course, over on the 602 Club, where we talk about all those other fandoms we love, not just Star Trek. So join us there. You can find me doing literary tracks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, we're doing the 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Deep Space Nine on the Orb, the 20th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Enterprise on Warp 5, and Saddle Up. We talk about Strange New Worlds, so we're looking forward to that coming back. And though over on the Nerd Party Network, you will find me doing two shows. One is completed. It's called Owlpost. I did that with Drea Kaufman. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then, of course, you can also find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. And Chris, maybe people, want to see what, wines you're drinking at your table with your blue food. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I love that blue food. Was that not one of the most unappetizing looking dinners you could possibly eat?
Pretty much.
I'm looking like, what is he eating? What is that? But no, when I'm not doing that, you can find me here on the network doing all those shows with you, which you mentioned. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time, and you can find me in all sorts of episodes in the back catalog on a variety of shows. And when I'm not doing that, I'm busy publishing magazines here in Tokyo. But if you would like to chat with me about Star Trek or whatever, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm most active on Twitter, but that is my username everywhere. And I'm also on Mastodon now if you want to find me there. Same thing, C. Brian Jones on the Trekkies.social instance. So I look forward to chatting with you online and social media. Now, if you would like to help us keep this show and everything else that we're doing going, we could really use your help. It does take a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows, and we wouldn't be here without the support of all of you who are listening. So if you'd like to find out how to get involved, maybe you want to become an associate producer of The Artificial Tango or our rewatches, you can find out how at Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us, because we wouldn't be able to talk about season 3 of Picard without your help. So thank you very, very much. Well, Matthew, that was a very long discussion for us. It reminds me of the old Ready Room days, but there was so much to cover in this first episode, and I'm looking forward to next week when we'll find out what happens in part 2 of Picard season 3.
Well, Chris, I cannot wait to get to that. And as Picard would say, shut it, Will.
Is that going to be our new tagline for the end of The Artificial Tango? Shut it, Will.
I thought it was pretty funny.
That's pretty funny.